welcome to this admittedly very late episode of Retro Raw. We're covering April 19, 1999. It's number 308 if you're following along with us on the network. Thank you for everyone who's kind of been bearing with us with kind of the crazy podcast shakeup schedule situation. But we are trying to get content out there. We're trying to get 1999 covered as well as 2019. My name is Sandra, and I am not joined here by Kenny McIntosh today, but I am joined by our resident retro heat correspondent who's been moved up to the big time for Raw, Finley Martin. How are you today?
I'm feeling great, Sandra. I've been promoted. It's not every day you get a promotion. That's it. So I'm feeling on top of the world.
You're no longer hanging out with the oddities and the Truth Commission on Heat. I mean, I know the Truth Commission hasn't been a thing for a long time, but I'm just trying to think of people who might be on Heat who don't appear on Raw very often, because I don't really watch Heat all that much.
Yeah. Well, it's this is the A show. You know, we've got the A commentary team of Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross. That was quite a, instead of Michael Cole and Kevin Kelly or Michael Cole and Shane McMahon. So it's definitely a different show. This is actually the first old episode of Raw that I have watched in its entirety in a very, very long time. So it was an interesting experience until we got to a certain match, but then it picked up from there. Let's go through it in a blow by blow in a chronological order.
Yes, let's absolutely do that. So we get an opening video package to open this Raw about last week's shenanigans of The Rock stealing Austin's Smoking Skull belt and threatening to throw it in the water. And then eventually, we think, throwing the belt in the water along with Steve Austin, throwing him in water as well in Detroit and presumably murdering him, question mark. And so The Rock actually opens the show by arriving to Raw in a hearse. And you know someone's a big star in 1999 if you get to arrive in a vehicle, right? And have vehicle shenanigans. So The Rock is obviously on top of the world here. He arrives in a hearse. When he gets out of the hearse, he is wearing a full suit with no shirt and a gold chain. It is quite the look, Finn.
It is quite the look. Some of that jewelry looked quite expensive. It looked suspiciously like a Rolex, which was the watch of choice for top level wrestlers back then, but he was, you know, The Rock was there and he was making a statement with his outfit.
He couldn't afford a shirt apparently, but maybe he just wanted to show off those glorious abs and the, you know, breast reduction surgery that he'd had. So
and something else, what he actually didn't throw into the river last week.
It's true. The Rock gets on the microphone. He talks about how he buried Austin's title. He buried Austin's career. So tonight, what's going to happen is The Rock is going to bury your dead monkey ass. And JR's like, we're going to have a funeral tonight. And The Rock's talking about how he's going to be delivering the damn eulogy. There's an actual casket and flowers and full buried alive set. I expected a buried alive match to break out at any moment because there's actually a grave dug at ringside. And The Rock actually opens his suit jacket at one point and is wearing the Smoking Skull belt, which we thought was gone. We thought was gone in the water, but apparently it is not. And the crowd is just absolutely apoplectic about this. They're chanting for Austin. They're chanting Rocky sucks. And I mean, The Rock guarantees that he's going to bury Steve Austin and he's the best damn WWF champion. And there's a camera waiting outside for Austin to arrive, which I was a little bit confused by because I thought he was presumed to be dead, but apparently we're waiting for him to arrive. But then I remembered that the big boss man who appears later on the show survived an actual hanging at WrestleMania. Yes. So death is not exactly a permanent feature here on Retro Raw. But what did you make of this opening promo? What did you think of The Rock and his shenanigans and threatening to bury Austin and all of that kind of stuff?
I felt like Rock had actually toned himself down just a little bit on the mic. Contrasting this with some of his promos on Heat, he's putting a lot more energy into them. But I think Rock was pacing himself. He didn't want to burn himself out. I mean, he was all over this program. I mean, he was on the program at various points during it and then was in the closing segment. So that was the reason why. I thought it was quite funny that he showed the Smoking Skull title belt. That was why he wasn't wearing a shirt, Sandra. it amused me as well when they showed the clips from the previous week and Rock apparently had thrown the Smoking Skull title belt into the river. And it was very obviously a big sound effect that they added on. Because the fucking skull title belt wouldn't make that much noise when it was thrown in the river. So I was onto him from the start.
You're on the case.
Yes. So, Rock had mentioned he was going to do Austin's eulogy later on in the night. So I thought it was a good setup promo. As I said, normally Rock would put more into it than he would put more into it than he did here. But he was saving himself for later in the show. So I thought it was a good little setup. As you said, what a set. I mean, no expense was spared, nor was it later in the program.
No, and I felt that they actually kind of went all out with this Buried Alive set, because not only did they have a grave dug at ringside, you know, as is standard in the World Wrestling Federation, but they actually had a full casket that wasn't one of your Undertaker and Paul Bearer specials where it's just kind of wooden boards together. Like, because their caskets always look kind of cheap. You know what I mean? Like, when they bring stuff out, it always kind of looks like, yes, you definitely built this in your garage, and I understand that that's what's happening here. This one was like, it looked like a pretty nice casket, and they had flowers all over. Like, I don't remember Buried Alive having that many flowers and floral arrangements. So, I mean, The Rock really has spared no expense here to make sure that he can bury the career of Stone Cold Steve Austin. And I like the fact that he was a little bit toned down, because The Rock has been getting cheered more and more lately. People have been kind of, you know, chanting his catchphrases along with him and that kind of stuff. So maybe this was an attempt to get them to not chant along with him quite as much, because he is supposed to still be a dastardly, dastardly baddie.
Yes, but we know that's going to end very soon. We can feel it, can't we?
We can feel it. I mean, I don't know anything for sure. I know no spoilers, but I do know a few spoilers. But I try not to. I try to avoid them as much as possible. We see Vince and Stephanie preparing for a TV interview of some sort, and Vince is talking to security, and Stephanie just looks like she is this, you know, proper girl, and she's just so happy to be in the, you know, care of her father. More on that later. But the next match that we have is Road Dogg versus Owen Hart. Road Dogg comes out, does his standard spiel, but he can't do his actual spiel anymore because he's not representing the New Age Outlaws quite as much. He's like, you know, I don't have a belt, but I'll soon be a tag team champion of the world. And Billy Gunn's not out with him, which I think is strange, because this whole match is to lead to Billy Gunn and Road Dogg versus Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett for the number one contendership for the tag team titles, right?
Yes.
And so I thought, like, where are your tag team partners? Why are they not out here with you? That seems strange that they're not accompanying you, but that's fine. And, you know, he's like, this is for Owen Hart, you damn nugget. I got two words for you. Suck it. And you could tell he was very proud of himself for rhyming. Road Dogg actually comes up with a tag team name for Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett here. He calls them Canadian Country. I don't believe we've heard them called that before, but that's actually quite a clever name. Why aren't we calling them that?
Well, that's a good question. Why aren't they calling them that? I mean, maybe. I mean, Canadian Country almost sounds like, mind you, I'm thinking of that awful Mickey James number, Hardcore Country.
But that's
But Canadian Country does sound like some low budget country music act that probably plays like the saloons in Calgary or places like that. I mean,
honestly, given Jeff Jarrett's former gimmick, I am all about it. Give me Canadian Country and give me a music video immediately. This is what I want in my life now. I think that would be incredible. I mean, I know that we've revealed Jeff Jarrett as not being the singer. I know that Road Dogg and Jeff Jarrett have their history, and Road Dogg is the actual singer of With My Baby Tonight, and it is not something I will ever forget because I love Jesse James and all of his glory. But Road Dogg also makes a stipulation here, and I did not know that Road Dogg was to blame for this phrase making its way into our lexicon, but Road Dogg says if Jeff Jarrett beats him, then Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart, Canadian Country, will be the number one contenders to the tag team titles. Fine, fair enough.
Yeah.
However, if Road Dogg wins, the world sees Deborah's puppies.
That's it. This was the dawn of that phrase becoming part, as you said, of the wrestling lexicon. And it got over immediately. And it got over.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, the person it got over the most with was, of course, Jerry Lawler.
Who could not be more excited.
Oh, I mean, he was pretty excruciating on commentary by the end of this. I was thinking about it, Jerry Lawler was actually my age when he did the commentary, when this show was broadcast, I believe he was 49. I think he was 50. I think he was born in 40. I think he was born in 1949, in November of 1949. So he would have been 50 that year. So he would have been 49 when this show was broadcast. And I am 49 now. And I've got to say, from one 49-year-old to another, I was embarrassed by many of the things that he said on this television program.
Well, I'm glad one of you has sense.
So, yeah, it was just Lawler just ignored the entire match and just talked about puppies throughout, much to the irritation or the indignation of Jim Ross, who I don't know how the hell he put up with Lawler for as long as he did.
Yeah, well, I mean, JR just can't be bothered with Jerry Lawler's bullshit here, and neither can I. It was incredibly frustrating. Now that I know who is to blame for puppies joining our lexicon, I can, you know, I guess direct my hatred toward Road Dogg, which is fine. I know Road Dogg gets a lot of heat on Twitter and whatnot for some of his SmackDown creative decisions lately, and so let's just add this to the mix, right? Like, he is the one who is to blame for wanting to reveal Deborah's puppies. I don't know how Road Dogg has the power to be like, oh, by the way, if I beat you in a wrestling match, then your valet has to undress before me. I don't know why Road Dogg, of all people on the show, has that power and why that's such a babyface thing, but you're right, Jerry Lawler is insufferable here. And I mean, it's no secret I'm not a big Jerry Lawler fan, but he spends the entire match of Road Dogg versus Owen Hart here just going, come here puppies, and he's like making dog noises, and it's really uncomfortable and disgusting, and just I don't understand how a human can objectify another human in that way. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, Deborah is a very good-looking woman. I think she is incredibly attractive, but it is very obvious here that she is just reduced to the pair of tits that Jerry Lawler wants to see. And I was thankful that Jeff Jarrett came in with a guitar and, like, I don't know, like, he got kind of mad because I'm trying to remember the actual finish of the match, right? Like, Road Dogg, I believe, pins Owen Hart.
That's right, yes.
So the crowd is just apoplectic about this, too. They're like, yes, we're going to get to see puppies. This is amazing. And they can't even hear Jerry Lawler in commentary. But the crowd, of course, wants to see Deborah. And Deborah doesn't look like she minds. Deborah's like,
she's all for it.
She is. She's like, hey, I look great. I might as well show this off. And you know what? Good for her. I don't have a problem with that. If it's her being like, yes, I would like to get my tits out now. Cool. Go for it. Do what you want to do. But so she takes off her suit jacket or opens her suit jacket. Jeff Jarrett runs in with a guitar, kind of like covers Deborah up, and no puppies for Lawler. And Lawler is very upset about this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the end of his world, isn't it?
It really is.
I mean, I thought it was a bit of a nothing match. I mean, Owen Hart to me didn't look like he could really be bothered. And Road Dogg's got like, there's only a few things that he does.
He mostly just shakes and, you know, like wiggles at you and then maybe drops an elbow sometimes. And that's about Road Dogg does.
That's it. And then the rest, and he'll do some punches. And then the rest of the time, he'll do a little bit of selling. And that's it. I mean, he's a guy that's really, if he's in a singles match and it lasts more than like 5 minutes, he's in trouble. He really is.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
Great interaction with the audience. And I've got to say, the guy was over. You know, he was over here as well. He always is. So, I mean, you know, you can't argue with success, Sandra.
You can't. I mean, he is definitely over. And even though he's not a great wrestler, he definitely has that connection with the crowd, like you say. It is kind of a bummer to see Owen Hart looking like he really doesn't want to be there. And I can't necessarily blame him. It's not like this is the most compelling story. I mean, I guess he is just a former tag team champion and a thrown together tag team. And that's kind of all we're going with, right? So it's a bummer knowing that we don't have much longer with Owen Hart, because we have less than a month with Owen Hart at this point. And he's just not doing a whole lot of anything.
Yeah, it's just over a month before what happens.
Isn't it like a month to the day of this episode?
Yeah, it's around about then. Yeah, it's the following month. Yeah. And it's just like, I think he sees Deborah as the star of the act. He knows that Deborah's the star of the act, and he's just there, and he doesn't want to overshadow her. So he's really taking this as an opportunity to really just do the bare minimum. And because he's talented, he can get away with that. I mean, for somebody who's less talented than him, I think it would be far more noticeable. But because he's such a good in-ring performer, he kind of gets away with it. And also, I think the overall standards, particularly in the mid-card, are so mediocre that Owen Hart on half speed is still better than almost everyone else.
Oh, you're not wrong. I mean, the wrestling on a lot of these old shows is atrocious. I mean, you know this watching Heat. It's not like the wrestling is exactly the focal point of 1999 WWF, right? So, yeah. I mean, Owen Hart can kind of get away with doing what Owen Hart's going to do. He's still a great performer, but the match itself was nothing. It was more about, let's see Deborah and her body.
Yes.
And we'll get more of that later. The Undertaker's seen backstage. He's talking to the Acolytes, my favorite crew. And he's like, "You two are my instruments of destruction." And he says, "We have bigger plans tonight and we cannot afford to waste time with the Brood." And Mr. Sandra at this point pointed out to me that Undertaker's shirt had a boob window, and that was our main focus in this segment. So the Undertaker apparently is entrusting the Acolytes to take care of the dastardly Brood later on in the show, is what I gathered from this. The Rock is showing rehearsing his eulogy, saying he's trying to get the opening right, and settles on "Trailer Park Trash, we are gathered here tonight." The Rock is actually pretty great on the show. I'm not a big Rock fan, but he's pretty funny throughout. And then we do get to the Brood versus the Acolytes. This is bad.
Yeah, the match, it lasted too long. It was Acolytes versus Edge and Gangrel. For some reason, Christian was stationed at ringside.
Which, by the way, the whole point of the Brood being against the Ministry at this point, Finn, which you wouldn't know from not watching Retro Raw, but Christian was the one who, when Ken Shamrock had him in an ankle lock, revealed the location of Stephanie McMahon in the basement of the arena. So Christian is the whole reason that the Ministry and the Brood have split. Why isn't Christian in this match?
I don't know. I mean, who really wants to see Gangrel wrestle? I mean, I don't. I don't ever need to see him wrestle again. I mean, I know I'm going to because I don't have much choice. But it's just like, I mean, Bradshaw did at least sell for Gangrel. You know, I mean, every time from this year, all I can think about is that Acolytes versus Public Enemy match. So to see Bradshaw sell at all, it, to me, is a bonus. But the match lasted far too long. In the end, Ken Shamrock ran in and nailed Bradshaw with a baseball bat. It actually looked like he really did strike him. They showed it on replay, and it sounded like he really belted him in the stomach.
Not going to lie, it was a bit cathartic.
That's right. And so that was it. Shamrock actually, and then Shamrock's running around at ringside. At one point, smashed a chair at ringside. The chair nearly flew into someone. I mean, there was a guy that got into character.
I don't know how much of a character it is with Ken Shamrock. I mean, he seems like a crazy person with too much pent-up energy at this point, and he is willing to go with that. You know, like, Ken Shamrock is great on these shows. He's been, since he kind of turned babyface and stopped being really, really creepy about trying to be overprotective of his sister, I've gone back to just loving Ken Shamrock and everything he's been doing on these shows. I was very happy that he appeared with a baseball bat to attack Bradshaw. First of all, because it's very nice to see Bradshaw get hit with a baseball bat, but also it stopped the match from going any further, because I think Bradshaw was about to powerbomb Edge or something like that when Ken Shamrock just kind of interferes. And Ken Shamrock going crazy at ringside, he is a character, like you say, and I think he's an effective one. I'm interested in Ken Shamrock. I want to see him beat people up. I want to see him go crazy. And he has a reason to be upset with the Ministry, because the Ministry was terrible to him and covered in, like, you know, Ken Shamrock covered in blood had to go rescue Stephanie McMahon and whatnot. The Ministry is the reason that Ken Shamrock got out of the corporation, because they, I don't know, didn't think he did well enough. I can't even remember what is all happening. But there are so many different, like, faction dynamics here. And Ken Shamrock, as a babyface, who is like, oh, I know, because Ken Shamrock got upset that the Ministry abducted his sister. Because Vince McMahon was like, okay, you can't have my daughter, but you can totally have Ken Shamrock's sister. That's fine. So Ken Shamrock's not very happy with that. And this is like an actual reasonable protection of his sister, because he doesn't want her to be sacrificed on the Undertaker symbol for, you know, reasons, being that that's not a very cool thing to do to another human.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's fair enough, isn't it?
It really kind of is.
It seems perfectly understandable, quite a rational reaction from Ken.
Yeah, I understand why he's upset. If someone tried to sacrifice my brother on a symbol, I wouldn't be very happy either. So all of the motivations for Ken Shamrock actually make sense. It makes sense why he's upset with the corporation. It makes sense why because the corporation let that happen to Ryan. It makes sense why he's upset with the ministry, because the ministry kidnapped his sister to try and get at Stephanie. And Ken Shamrock just being the crazy guy who's out for justice really works for me. So I think he was kind of the star of this segment. But backstage, Paul Bearer is telling The Undertaker, because The Undertaker's raging, of course, because the Acolytes did not get the job done. They didn't eviscerate the Brood or whatever The Undertaker wanted to happen. And Paul Bearer tells The Undertaker it wasn't their fault. Ken Shamrock came in with a baseball bat. What were they supposed to do? And The Undertaker's just raging. And
he's throwing things around. I mean, that's when you know someone's mad. They start throwing a stepladder around and chairs and tables.
Whenever the backstage set starts getting upset, you know that things are about to go down.
Yeah, and sure enough, they did.
And they did. During the ad break, the Acolytes are trying to explain their failure, and the Undertaker's just like, this is unacceptable. And then so Viscera comes in. Viscera and the Undertaker beat up the Acolytes. And honestly, Finn, isn't that kind of what the Undertaker gets for choosing such a shit ministry?
Well, it is. I mean, I couldn't get my head around this at all. It was just... You know, it's like, it's not the Acolytes. I mean, we don't like the Acolytes, okay? We're not fans of the Acolytes.
No,
but in their defense, it's not their fault that Ken Shamrock ran in and hit him with a baseball bat. I mean, how about some sympathy? You know, Bradshaw's just hit with a baseball bat. Undertaker, there's no sympathy from the Undertaker. They get backstage and then they get beaten up. I mean,
basically, the Undertaker is not the best human at this point in our Retro Raw journey.
I mean, and who would want to be a member of the ministry? I wouldn't.
No, not at all. I mean, it makes more sense to be a member of the corporation under maniacal Vince McMahon, or Shane McMahon now, apparently.
Yeah, so, exactly.
I mean, so, The Undertaker is just, he's not really proving great leadership qualities.
Well, he is. I mean, what's his incentives? You know, what are the features and benefits of being a member of the ministry? I can't think of any.
I mean, I think we would have to examine this. Maybe once the ministry gets some business cards and becomes a corporate ministry, then we can lay out a plan of action.
That's it. You know, where's the job description or what's in it for me?
I mean, I need an org chart.
That's what the wrestlers want to know. What's in it for me?
And I think more of the wrestlers are finding out that there isn't anything in it for them. I mean, the Brood has split. It seems that the Acolytes are having dissension in the ministry now. I mean, honestly, if you screw up in the ministry, you get, like, hung by your arms, whipped backstage. This is what happened to Christian. And then you still get beat up the next week. I understand why the Brood is so upset. So, yeah. I mean, the ministry, it just seems, is a shambles at this point.
Absolutely. Speaking of the shambles, the Godfather is the Intercontinental Champion.
He sure is. He sure is, because he beat Goldust for the Intercontinental Championship last week. Do you know how this happened?
Well, I've kind of like erased it from memory because I don't need to relive why this happened. The fact that he is the Intercontinental Champion, it was something that I just kind of buried. I just, I buried it in that grave set, that they built for Austin.
It's been hanging out with the Rage Party in your mind, just...
I mean, the Godfather is Intercontinental Champion. I mean,
because the Big Boss Man was supposed to face Goldust last week, right? And the Godfather offered the Big Boss Man five ladies, basically. The Boss Man was like, I want all of them. And so then the Godfather got the match instead because he lured the Boss Man away from the match with the ladies, and then he won. And now he's the Intercontinental Champion. And then the ladies came out to celebrate with him, so the Boss Man didn't even get his time with the ladies. I question everything about the Godfather's fiscal responsibility methods. But the Godfather wants us to all chant Pimpin' Ain't Easy. Maybe it would be easier if you were better at it. But Hardcore Holly, who is the Hardcore Champion, is getting an Intercontinental title shot against the Godfather for reasons.
Why is this taking place? Why is this match taking place? I mean, it's just nonsensical.
None of this makes any sense at all.
I mean, the only good thing you can say about this match is that it didn't last very long, and thank Vince Russo for that.
Yes, thank Vince Russo for that indeed. I was surprised the Godfather didn't even offer his ladies to Hardcore Holly, so maybe he's actually examined his model of pimping and realizing that maybe offering the ladies for free is not the best method of going about things. The match is bad. Jimmy Corderas gets knocked down at one point when Godfather has Hardcore Holly in a fireman's carry, and Hardcore Holly starts using weapons. He uses a baking sheet, he uses a broom, and Goldust comes down and interferes, pulls Godfather out of the ring, but then Al Snow runs in, hits Hardcore Holly with head. Godfather pins Hardcore Holly, and then Goldust attacks him. This is basically to set up the two feuds, Goldust versus the godfather for the Intercontinental Championship at Backlash, and Al Snow, who is still on his quest to defeat Hardcore Holly for the Hardcore Championship. It was shenanigans, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. I mean, at the end of it, who really wanted to see any match between any combination of these people? I didn't. I don't really want to. I mean,
no, nor me. No.
Godfather as IC champion. Get that title off him, please.
That would be ideal. You know, I actually saw the Godfather this past weekend.
Oh, really?
He was at Players Brawl.
Told me he was going to be there. Was he doing brisk business for his Papa Shango and Godfather gimmicks? And got
it seems that way. Because so he opened the show as Godfather, and I got there a little bit late because I had to work until 2, and then it's like a 2-hour drive, so I got there just at 4. So he opened the show as the Godfather, which was fun. Everyone got to see him and whatnot. I'm sure he was doing meet and greet stuff too beforehand. And then he switched into Papa Shango later and put a spell on Danny Adams, which was great. And elicited a "You Still Got It" chant for putting a spell on someone, basically just holding out a skull and having Danny Adams like fall down. It was actually really good. It was a lot of fun. And then like the weirdest thing was I was getting a drink at intermission in between buying merch, because I have a merch problem. But so I was in line to get a drink. I had just ordered the beer that I wanted, and Papa Shango comes up and is like, "Is it okay if I cut in line in front of you guys? Because I have to get back down there." And I was like, this is just an interaction I didn't expect to ever have in my life, where wow. Papa Shango is cutting in front of me in line for drinks.
The question is, can you confirm, is Charles Wright Papa Shango the Godfather? Is he 6'8"? As Jim Ross stated on commentary.
I don't know that I would say he is 6'8". He's tall. He's a very tall man. But I don't believe that he is 6'8".
That did sound like a wild exaggeration to me.
I would say that is a wild exaggeration. Even yes. With lifts, he wouldn't be 6'8".
Yeah, I didn't think so. Yeah, that's what Jim Ross said on commentary. He also later said that Viscera is 6'10".
I also don't think that's true.
No, neither do I. But Jim,
if you look at Viscera standing next to The Undertaker...
But Jim Ross was in full effect on this program.
He definitely was. And bless him. Bless him for these exaggerations, making the superstars feel larger than life.
Exactly.
So who can possibly be bothered about any of the shambles? I guess we'll see 2 matches at Backlash that we don't really want to see. Yeah. But The Undertaker is shown backstage on the phone to Midian, and he says to get it done, or it will be Midian who pays penance to the Lord of Darkness. Again, I question The Undertaker's leadership skills in trusting anything to Midian at this point, but...
Yeah. Yeah, Undertaker warned Midian not to fail him. Again, you know, Midian's probably after that phone call, he's possibly considering tendering his resignation from the ministry.
I would. I mean, even though, like, Midian got brought into the ministry by being whipped in a basement for a while and then sacrificed on a symbol. Like, yeah. I just don't really see what's in this for Midian. And I don't really understand why The Undertaker was like, I need someone for my ministry. Midian's the best choice.
I mean, thinking about it, I mean, I know what happens to Midian after the ministry disbands, and that's even worse than this. So, I mean, really just be thankful for what he's got right now.
I suppose so. I've heard horror stories, and we will get there. We will get there. The Rock is backstage. A lady is shining his shoes, and she's like, my, what big tassels you have, which is definitely supposed to be sexual. And The Rock tells her to shut her mouth and continue to shine The Rock's shoes. And The Rock is just preparing for his eulogy, basically.
Yeah.
But next we get Ken Shamrock versus the Big Boss Man. Ken Shamrock and Boss Man come out. They start brawling outside the ring right away, which I thought was actually a pretty fun start to the match.
Yeah,
they have some dissension with one another. It actually got going. Like, this is kind of where the show picked up a little bit for me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this was no holds barred. It really felt like they disliked each other, which is, you know, the message that wrestlers are supposed to project when the feud has reached this level of intensity. You know, show us in your actions that you detest each other. And fans really responded very well to the action. I mean, it wasn't a particularly long match, but I thought it was pretty good. The peaked at the finish. I thought for Shamrock and the Boss Man, this was all right. This was pretty good. Yeah.
No, I'm glad you agree, because I actually really liked this match, and the crowd was super up for it, like you say. I mean, the crowd was really into this, more than I would expect them to be into a Big Boss Man match, right? Like, I mean, I like the Big Boss Man. I'm a fan of the Big Boss Man, but he has not been the most effective member of the corporation lately, I think it's fair to say. So it was kind of great to see him, like, just attack Ken Shamrock and just kind of go at it, and it made sense for both of them. I mean, there was a Hurricane Rana where it looked kind of almost really dangerous. Like, the Boss Man landed on Ken Shamrock in a way that did not look intentional, but it led to the finish. Like you say, Ken Shamrock wins. And I mean, the Ministry is the least effective ever at this point. But it's crazy that the Big Boss Man, you know, he survived a hanging recently. Within the past month, he has been hanged in the middle of the ring, and he still puts on a really fun match with Ken Shamrock here.
Exactly.
On the show.
He's putting them all to shame. I mean, this guy was only dead like 3 weeks ago, and
right?
He's putting on a match of this caliber.
He's a lot more effective than the other dead man at this point, right? Like, Undertaker gets up on the Tron and is like, it's getting late. Do you know where your sister is? Referring to Ryan Shamrock, who the Undertaker has, you know, kidnapped before and whatnot. And this is something that just popped me, because I think they must have been in Lansing, Michigan for this particular show. I don't remember them mentioning that they were in Lansing. But the Undertaker gets on the Tron and says, you know, why would you leave her in a hotel room outside of Lansing on Interstate 96? And I'm like, ooh, I know exactly where that is, because that's really near where I live. Because I am that person that pops for local reference, Finn. It's, you know, I know who I am. It's fine. But
it's an American. Well, it's not just an American thing. It's a UK thing as well. I'm sure if, you know, if they were to localize promos and segments at the Raw and SmackDown tapings, which they sometimes do, people pop for that as well.
And it's just fun. It's like, oh, you're mentioning a place near where I'm from. I can understand that. It's a good time. It does make me wonder which hotel, because I've stayed in some hotels outside of Lansing that are not great, because I don't have money. And so, like, when Undertaker's like, I even know what room she's in. I'll start knocking on room 223. Ha 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 ha. And I'm just like, I wonder if she's at that Red Roof I stayed in one time where it was sketchy and there were drug deals going on outside.
Well, I mean, if there's 223 rooms there, it's a pretty big place.
I mean, it could have been. Mr. Sandra posited they were at Motel 666. But
I guess that was just a cliche too far, even for Vince Russo.
I know, right? I did roll my eyes and laugh simultaneously at him. I thought, yes, that's the man I married. But Jerry Lawler's just like, why would you leave your sister in some hotel and come here when she's in peril like that? And I'm like, you mean a grown woman who should really be able to take care of herself? And also, I think Ken Shamrock has done the more responsible thing than Vince McMahon, because he has left his sister away from Raw. Like, he has left her away from the taping because he knows The Undertaker is going to be at Raw. So he's like, I don't want her to be at Raw because she gets kidnapped when she's at Raw. So yeah. I will leave her somewhere else. I mean, the fact that The Undertaker found out where she is not great, but I would say it's almost more responsible to leave her not at the arena.
Well, I would say so, since it hasn't worked out very well for her in the past. I mean, what Shamrock needs to find out is who is the stooge?
You know, exactly.
Where's the leak been? You know, he needs to get the plumbers in to plug up that leak. You know, where is this information coming from? How has The Undertaker discovered or learned that Ryan is in room 223 of this mysterious motel? So upon hearing this, Shamrock freaks out and he does a runner. And I think that was it for Shamrock for the rest of the show, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think we get any more of him. I guess maybe we'll find out what happens next week if The Undertaker did go and accost Ryan Shamrock, if Ken Shamrock was able to get to her in time. But he's off to the hotel and off the show for the rest of the night. We get Mankind versus Triple H after this, your favorite match. Mean Street Posse's on commentary. Pete Gass, it looks so happy to be there. Looks so happy to be there. But the Mean Street Posse is talking about how they went to find Mankind in the boiler room last week, and Pete Gass is like, you know, Mankind jumped us from behind. That's why we got, you know, beat up. You know, in Greenwich, people come at you straight in the face on the mean streets of Greenwich. And commentary the rest of the night, or the rest of this match, rather, is basically just talking about the mean streets of Greenwich and how, you know, Greenwich fights are. So I love the Mean Street Posse. They are definitely a weakness of mine. So I enjoyed this wholeheartedly. I didn't necessarily enjoy the match wholeheartedly because it was Mankind versus Triple H and it was bad.
It was. I mean, Mankind just, I mean, we know he needs knee surgery. He looks like he's in a lot of pain. He can barely move. I mean, I couldn't believe how unover both of these two were at the beginning of this match. I mean, contrast it with Shamrock versus Bossman. I mean, mm-hmm. You think the Triple H and Mankind, they're much bigger stars, certainly on paper, than
Mankind
Shamrock and Bossman.
Least.
Yeah, and I mean, they just the audience just was not into this. We've got China at ringside as well. I mean, fans did get into the match because mainly because Mankind took so much abuse, which is what he does and what he had. This was how he got over. This was the story of his career. Take loads of abuse and people will finally respond to you. In the end, China tripped Mankind and rammed him testicles first into the ring post, and the referee called for the bell. So after that, all sorts of madness. All sorts of craziness after the match, Sondra.
There was all sorts of craziness after the match. I mean, China gets involved in the match quite a bit. She, you know, at first punches Mankind. She slams him on the outside at one point. And then, like you say, the match finishes when she, you know, pulls him groin first into the ring post. And the referee actually sees it and calls for a disqualification, which in 1999 means that, you know, he was one of the best referees ever because he actually called for a disqualification when it was warranted. But, I mean, Triple H... I know that I rail on Triple H a lot on this podcast, but he was so boring in this match. Could his knee drops look any more awkward and terrible, Finn? Like, are bad.
He just looked like he just couldn't be bothered either. And like, where was
he? He doesn't have the skill that Owen Hart does to not be bothered and still be good.
It just felt like it was totally phoned in. And then we had all these people coming in afterwards, the Mean Street Posse, the Corporation. And they're all
The posse comes in kind of immediately, and then Big Show lazily saunters to the ring. I would say Big Show did a run-in, but Big Show doesn't seem to do run-ins on Retro Raw. Big Show lazily saunters.
That's
to
right.
Take the whole corporation on, quote unquote, but he just really looks like he wants a nap. I mean,
Big Show just looks like he'd rather be backstage, you know, pigging out, you know what I mean?
Basically. I mean, like, Boss Man and Test and the Posse are all trying to, like, beat up Mankind and all this stuff, and Big Show just kind of, like, lazily saunters out, one chokeslam to Test, and the corporation scatters, even though, I mean, he looks like he is spent at this point. Like, he did one chokeslam to Test, and he looks like he can do no more moves, but the corporation's, like, don't want to risk it, apparently. And of course,
Jim Ross is on commentary telling us what an incredible athlete the Big Show is. And you're like, and he was banging on about that later on in the match with Viscera as well. And you're like, well, he doesn't look like a particularly good athlete to me.
It looks like his lazily sauntering blew him up getting to the ring.
Exactly. It's like, you know, maybe he doesn't want to run, you know, because that might be, well, firstly, he's going to blow himself up. But it's like he doesn't want to do any cardiovascular exercise because he might get in better shape, which might then require him to put more effort into his matches.
This is the plan. He can't move any quicker because it might cause him to be better.
Yeah.
I think you've cracked it. I think you've cracked the code. I mean, I am not an athletic person, right? Like, I cannot say anything about any of the wrestlers being unathletic or whatever, but I feel like I could run to the ring and be less tired looking than Big Show, which is not a good sign because I have asthma and cannot run. So,
I mean, but this guy is paid $950,000 a year downside to be athletic.
Mm-hmm.
That is why he is there. That is his job description, to be athletic or at least look it, or at least make us believe that he is this guy that Jim Ross tells us he is on commentary.
I mean, so, Viscera looks better than the Big Show.
Yeah. So, I mean, also, the other weird thing about this was, I mean, it's Big Show out to make the save for Mankind, and Jim Ross cannot understand why Big Show has come out to save Mankind. Mankind takes the mic and is like, I appreciate it, but we're still having this boiler room match or boiler room brawl at Backlash. It did. I mean, they were trying to spin it as, well, it's out of respect, but it just all felt a bit hollow to me.
Well, it is strange because they are going to have this boiler room brawl match, whatever, at Backlash. I have heard that it's atrocious. I haven't seen it yet. I am going to see it soon. this is my dedication to Inside the Ropes. But yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be a show of respect, and they kind of have a common enemy in the corporation, right? Because Big Show was in the corporation. He is no longer in the corporation. Mankind obviously has been feuding with the corporation for a long time. Mankind versus the corporation has been an effective story. The Big Show's face turn, I had to ask Kenny on air, is the Big Show meant to be a face now? He told me that he was. Apparently this is face Big Show trying to be a thing. He doesn't seem super likable. He just seems super bored. So Mankind...
He turned at WrestleMania 15, didn't he? I think that was the official point where he turned.
I mean, you're probably right. It is hard to tell for me when the Big Show actually turned, because he never, like, he still just seems bored and like he doesn't want to be there. But I guess, like, he's helping Mankind and is against the corporation, so I guess he's just de facto face now. But yeah, this was meant to be a show of respect. It'll play into the show a little bit later as well. We see The Rock backstage or on the phone outside a car talking about throwing Austin off the bridge, bragging about his car. He's still being The Rock. We get an advertisement for an all new primetime network special, Finn. SmackDown is coming.
SmackDown. Yeah, taped April 27th, broadcast April 29th on UPN, which I'm not sure what UPN is now. That's a network show anyway, isn't it? Network show.
Yeah. I mean, it was on, we didn't have it on over-the-air network. It was on, like, the most basic of basic cable where I was. But, yeah, I mean, UPN was, it was a pretty big channel. And we'll figure out how we're covering SmackDown in the next couple weeks. Again, apologies, like, bear with us as we try to catch up on stuff. But there will be some SmackDown discussion of the first episode of SmackDown for sure.
I mean, it was a huge show at the time. I remember it being huge, and it wasn't long after that was broadcast that then it was picked up and it began in the fall season. So, I mean, it was a huge success, drew a fabulous rating. I mean, this was treated as a big, big show, pardon the pun, by WWF, as it was at the time. You know, they wanted an additional television program. They wanted the money that was going to come from it. They certainly didn't want all the hassle that was going to come from it, but that's another story for a later date.
I mean, I'm sure we will get to that in future.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, just another couple of things there, Sonny. Yeah, we still don't really know why Mankind and Big Show are having this match in the Boiler Room, which should be like the ultimate feud settler, or is a match in that's a place in which two people who really hate each other would fight. So two people who actually respect each other, why exactly are they having this Boiler Room brawl? That's all a bit odd.
I don't know, because they fought at WrestleMania over being a referee. So they've been in a feud over being referees. It's not like this is a blood feud. Like, they just both wanted to officiate a match is essentially what we're meant to get from it. And if they're both on the same side now, I have no idea why they're going to be fighting in a Boiler Room at Backlash on Sunday.
No, and probably we will never find out.
So. I mean, Mankind did say that he was going to shut himself in a Boiler Room for 2 weeks until he could face the Big Show. I'm trying to remember why. I can't remember why. I did watch that show.
I mean, you know what? At this point, it doesn't really matter, does it?
They're going to have a brawl in a Boiler Room. Apparently, Mankind, that's just where he feels comfortable, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. We now get to Billy Gunn versus Jeff Jarrett. So it's the other side of the tag team match that we're going to be seeing at Backlash in 7 days' time. Six days' time.
And Billy Gunn comes out and says, Jeff Jarrett, I think you cheated these people out of seeing a little TNA tonight. Genuinely took me a solid minute to realize it wasn't a dig at TNA, the company.
Yeah, no, that didn't exist. That doesn't exist for 3 more years.
No, but I'm like, Jeff Jarrett, TNA, makes sense. I was like, how did they get to the future? I don't understand. Oh, you just mean tits and ass. Okay. And Jerry Lawler is like, well, at least the T. Why don't we get to see the T? I just can't with him. But Billy Gunn insists that Deborah show some TNA, and if you're not down with that, suck it. Like, there's something disturbing about the implication of this promo being the babyface saying, you must disrobe for me and show me your body, or your other alternative is to suck my dick.
You know what? It's just occurred to me, Sandra, that you should never read Jerry Lawler's autobiography.
I never planned to.
The real Jerry Lawler is not dissimilar. He's turned up a bit, this version of Jerry Lawler. Obviously, the volume's turned up a bit, But the real Jerry Lawler is not a million miles away from the on-screen Jerry Lawler. So that's a book to avoid.
That is not 100% shocking to me. I mean, I've met Jerry Lawler. He was pleasant enough to me. I'm too old for him, so he didn't hit on me or anything like that. But that is a book I plan to avoid for sure. But yeah, Billy Gunn basically says the same stipulation as in the Road Dogg Owen Hart match. Basically, like, if he wins, then Deborah has to, you know, show her tits. The match starts, and Billy Gunn versus Jeff Jarrett is actually not a bad match, right? Like, Billy Gunn versus Jeff Jarrett, they are both good at wrestling, but Owen Hart kind of comes out immediately to attack Billy Gunn, and then Road Dogg happens, and Earl Hebner can't keep control because, of course, it's 1999 and he's a referee. I am so tired of Jerry Lawler's puppies jokes, and it has only been a thing for less than an hour, and I am not looking forward to the rest of life on Retro Raw when that's
the next five years.
Great. Amazing. So looking forward to the next 5 years. Owen Hart interferes in the match after Billy Gunn's famous sort of Jeff Jarrett, which causes a DQ. So there's not a finish in this match either, but Billy Gunn does technically win the match. Deborah takes off her jacket and she's going for her bra. And Jerry Lawler's like, it's the hardest thing in the world to get one of those off. No, you're just bad at it. Die in a fire. And then Jerry Lawler's like, it's a wonder bra. I'd know it anywhere. Ha ha. No. Jerry Lawler, here's a little piece of education for you. There is no way that Deborah is wearing a Wonder Bra here. You know why? Wonder Bras are not available in those sizes, and they certainly weren't available in those sizes in 1999. Deborah's breasts are way too large for a Wonder Bra. It's a push-up bra. It's pushing them up and together. There is no way that's a Wonder Bra. Trust me, I have been Wonder Bra shopping. They don't fit me. They certainly didn't fit Deborah.
Well, thanks for that, Sandra.
I'm just saying. See, this is the knowledge that I bring to Retro. but Jerry Lawler was just infuriating here. And Deborah looks like she's going for it, right? But again, like, she gets covered up and doesn't take off her bra, and the segment ends. I mean, it's really just become the Deborah show now, hasn't it?
It's become the Deborah show. It's the Deborah show. You know, hey, in real life, she's seen Steve Austin by this point. You know,
Okay.
It's all on between those two. That became official just a few weeks earlier, I believe. So, but yeah, that's all on Debs and Steve Austin backstage.
And
so that could explain why she's being pushed.
Yeah, it would make sense. And I mean, Deborah's great. I don't mind Deborah as a character at all. I think she's actually very good at what she does. And the dynamic between her and Jeff Jarrett is interesting because, like, she's well up for getting her body out and showing it off and whatnot. She's like, I look good and I know it. And then Jeff Jarrett kind of wanting to cover her up as the heel thing. But she also doesn't seem to... I don't get, like, a Sable Mark Miro vibe from this where Deborah is upset at Jeff Jarrett for trying to cover her up. Like, in the way that Sable was upset at Mark Miro for trying to cover her up. But it's kind of it's a similar story, it seems, that they're telling. And I don't mind characters like Deborah being sexualized on the show. That doesn't bother me. It's just that, like, this is the only representation that we get. And then Jerry Lawler is just insufferable. The screeching just really gets to me. And I'm not looking forward to the next 5 years of his commentary.
No, it gets much worse. Yeah, you don't, there's no implication that Jeff Jarrett and Deborah is like a power and control thing or a, you know, DV thing. You don't get the feeling that it's anything like that. There's nothing sort of sinister there.
No.
It all seems rather harmless where Jeff Jarrett's sort of doing this, but he's not doing it. He's doing it because he wants to be a good person. He's not doing it because he wants to be a controlling, you know, other half.
No, and he doesn't seem like, you know, Deborah's trying to upstage me and I'm so upset about that. I think that's the difference between, like, Mark Miro and Sable and then Jeff Jarrett and Deborah here. Whereas Mark Miro was upset that Sable was taking his spotlight, Jeff Jarrett's just like, no, it's not time for that now.
Yeah.
You know, stop.
No.
So the dynamic makes Jeff Jarrett seem like a better person than Mark Miro, which is strange to compare. But a lady backstage wants to interview The Rock for .com, quote unquote. And The Rock's like, hell no, I'm practicing my eulogy speech. Go away, skank.
Yeah, he was extremely unpleasant to the woman. And looking at the woman, she was either A, an excellent actress, or B, had no idea what The Rock was going to say to her. Because she looked genuinely shocked.
She looked genuinely shocked and upset. And you know what? I would be kind of upset if someone just called me a skank for trying to do my job and interview a man.
Well, this is the Attitude Era.
Yes, it is. Yes, it sure is. And in the Attitude Era, we get such great matches as Big Show versus Viscera.
Yes.
The match everyone's clamoring to see.
Yeah, Viscera's 6'10", according to Jim Ross.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
He looks like significantly shorter than the Big Show.
Yeah, Big Show's about, I think Big Show's about 7 foot, so genuinely. So, yeah, I don't think Viscera's 6'10". But, I mean, this is the Attitude Era, and everyone's larger than life. And if they're not, well, we're going to make them larger than life.
We're just going to say that they are, and believe us, trust me, that cell is 30 feet high. It just is, right?
Exactly.
I mean, thankfully, the match doesn't last too long before the lights go out and The Undertaker happens on the Tron. He walks out with Paul Bearer. The Big Show looks so tired after not a match. Like, he barely has a match with Viscera, and he looks like he cannot handle life.
He looks like he's been on, like, a massive, like, session the night before and hasn't really recovered. He kind of looks hungover.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just looks like it's all too much for him.
It really does. And I mean, The Undertaker and Big Show face off, which I guess is kind of a cool moment, or it's supposed to be a big confrontation. And it was kind of like, oh, okay, The Undertaker and Big Show are facing off. That seems like it should be a big deal. And they go for a mutual choke slam. They kind of grab at each other's throats. And the crowd chants for Austin for some reason, which I thought was strange because Austin's not really involved with either of these men, but they apparently just want to see Austin instead of these men, which I mean, I can't blame them. Austin's a lot cooler than they are. But, Mankind does come out, helps Big Show kind of to return the favor from earlier tonight. Viscera and Undertaker leave, and then there's like a meaningful glance of respect from Big Show to Mick Foley, but they will face off on pay-per-view in 6 days, Finn.
They will do. I mean, I thought the Undertaker-Big Show portion was pretty hot, and just watching the Undertaker move at this point, I mean, he can move so well. I mean, he's actually in great shape physically. I know he was hurting, because he disappears later in the year because he's got all sorts of injuries. Sorry to spoil that for you. But I mean, we know the Undertaker is hurting, but he moves really well. I mean, maybe it's just a comparative thing. And like, he moves really well.
In comparison to the stationary and looking like he's going to fall over Big Show. Yes, he's moving. But you're not wrong. I mean, the Undertaker does run the ropes and he's basically just like running around the Big Show because that's kind of what he has to do in the segment.
He's creating all the action. You know, and Mankind's obviously in rough shape at this point as well. So I thought Undertaker looked pretty good here. And fans were into that square off between Undertaker and Big Show.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't a total waste. Not far off, but not a total waste.
It wasn't the worst thing. It was not. I can't say that it really made me want to see an Undertaker-Big Show match necessarily. But I kind of, you know, it was kind of a cool face-off between characters who haven't really done that before. This is the point in the show where we get the Vince and Stephanie interview that's been kind of hyped throughout.
Yeah.
First, we get a video package about Shane's power trip, firing the Briscoes last week, slapping Vince, saying, "You're not my father anymore. You're not even Mr. McMahon anymore. You're just Vince." And Michael Cole is interviewing Vince McMahon with Stephanie. And Vince says, you know, I think Michael Cole asked him, "Are you proud of your son, Shane?" And Vince says he's always been proud of Shane. You know, I might not have always been there as a father because I was building a business. You know, I missed a lot of moments. And Shane must have missed a lot of moments without me being there. But I've always been proud until last Monday. I wasn't proud of that. And it's this big emotional thing, right? Like where Vince McMahon is saying he's proud of his son, which if you listen to Shane McMahon interviews, I think Shane did that Stone Cold podcast on the WWE Network. Or was it with Mankind? I can't remember. But Shane has said that Vince saying that he's proud of him is not a thing that really ever happened. And then if you look at the recent story with Shane McMahon and The Miz, too, I just kind of kept getting, ooh, yes, this is where the daddy issues begin. Michael Cole asked Stephanie, you know, what do you think about all of this? And Stephanie just, she's dressed in powder blue. She has her hair in 90s clips. Like they are making her look as childlike as possible. Vince is like holding her hand and she kind of has this deer in the headlights look. And she's like, I just don't know what to think anymore. I mean, that's my brother Shane. To suddenly feel like you don't know your own flesh and blood anymore. It's confusing. Like, I feel like I just don't know anyone anymore. And
you know, the one person.
Yeah. And she's like, the one person who stood by my side has been my father. I feel very protected, very safe. And there's just a creepy dynamic here, Finn. Like, is it me reading too much into this or is this like.
No, you are right. I mean, Stephanie was 22 at the time.
Yes.
But I mean, she looked, you know, you could say she looked like 17, 18. She was made, she looked very young here. And you're just thinking, wow, I don't ever remember her looking that young. And no doubt that was the intention, and that was how they dressed her and made her up and lit her to look that young. And it was just weird. I mean, what's weird about it is knowing everything that's going to happen over the next 20 years.
Yes.
So it's very hard. I think sometimes when you watch these 20-year-old programs, a lot of times you can transport yourself back in time and you can imagine how it was, or for me, remember how it was. But with Stephanie, it's sort of a bit weird because of just what an ogre she became as a character over the years. And to see her like this, and you just, I don't know, it's just, she's always been a strange character to me. She's somebody that's been a great source of irritation for me for many years, you know, because of the character she's played. And so often the characters have been unhelpful or they just haven't been constructive towards other characters or the overall storylines or the promotion in general. And just seeing her play this character here was just, I just would rather not think about it. I just find it just weird. I've always found it weird. There's been times when she's been effective, but more often than not, like, I don't know what the ratio is, 9 to 1, more often than not, she's just been a hindrance. And this was
you're
just
not wrong. And just all of the childlike imagery with her is really strange to me too. Yeah. I mean, I've said it for a couple of weeks on here, but like using a teddy bear to kind of introduce Stephanie, they're really making out that she's a child.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even though she is 22, she is a grown adult, but on this program, they're really making out that she's the child who needs to be protected by her father. And there's just a weird daddy-daughter dynamic here that feels very Donald Trump and Ivanka, and I don't feel good about it.
Yeah.
But so there's a security guy who comes and says that there's a problem outside, and Vince is incensed. He growls and runs down the hallway in the most ridiculous fashion. His running is definitely something else. He says for Stephanie to stay there. He's like, he's entrusting Michael Cole to protect Stephanie at this point, which seems suspect, but okay.
Vince didn't tear a quad, you know?
He did not tear a quad.
I used to run down this alleyway and outside without suffering any muscle tears.
Good for him. You know what? We'll consider that a victory. And Midian's in the parking lot outside the TV facility. Vince beats him up. Vince takes Midian's car and tries to run over Midian. But Midian moves and Vince just runs into the building instead. And at first I thought that Midian had stolen the car, but it turns out it was Midian's car. He drives away. This has escalated. There was just attempted murder. Midian did not get the job done. He ran away instead.
Exactly. I mean, is there going to be anyone left in the ministry by next week?
I don't think so. I think the ministry feels like it's crumbling beneath the Undertaker's feet. I don't imagine the Undertaker's going to be very happy about that.
I wouldn't have thought so. I found this, I mean, to look to me like Vince isn't at work. It looked to me like Vince was really punching and kicking Midian. Looked like he was really nailing him. I mean, the whole segment was very poorly lit. And I felt the same way as well about the closing segment that we were going to get to in a moment. Mm-hmm. Again, the lighting could have been so much better. It was difficult to see what was going on. There's no way WWE in 2019 would have produced segments that were this underlit. It just would not happen. And as you say, it was kind of tricky to work out what was going on there. And it was only when they showed it on replay that, oh, yeah, that's what happened. So, yeah, Vince beat up Midian, looked like he was really nailing him. Jumped in the car, then we had a change of camera angles, and then he reversed the car into the wall. Happily, Midian had moved, and then I think Midian threw Vince out of the car, and it looked like Vince took a hell of a bump from being thrown out of the car, and then Midian drove off, presumably to be fired or worse by the Undertaker.
I mean, the Undertaker doesn't just tend to fire people. He tends to do nasty things to them. So I don't really feel that Midian's chances are great of having a great outcome of this segment. But yeah, I mean, it did feel chaotic. I'll give it that. It felt chaotic. I didn't expect, you know, Midian to almost be run over by a car in this segment. So
yeah, I mean, when Vince tried to crush his legs and his pelvis, and like, just that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the attitude. You can't think about these things too deeply.
I mean, things are escalating, Finn.
They are.
So who better to go to after, you know, attempted manslaughter than Val Venus? Val Venus comes out for a match, presumably. We never find out who the match was supposed to be with. He says that he's... So Val Venus is supposed to be, right, like, sexy man who delivers sexy promos with double entendres and all this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
His sexy promo today is... he solved the Y2K problem. All you have to do is add a few megabytes of RAM from this hard drive and you won't care what year it is. Like... His puns aren't even really that sexy anymore. I suppose, like, RAM and hard drive means that he's going to ram you with his penis or something. But, like, he's really reaching. I feel like the puns are not even sexy anymore and not that effective. He's just saying things in a growly voice at this point.
Well, I mean, let's face it. It's, you know, Valley's pretty much had his run. I mean, he did all right. And, you know, at this point, Right to Censor can't come soon too soon enough for me.
I am so excited. I don't know when they appear, but I am so excited because I love Right to Censor. So I cannot wait.
Yeah.
But Sable appears because, you know, we needed less charisma in the segment. And Sable says that she's the diva of the World Wrestling Federation. She has a very important announcement. Val, your match is just going to have to wait. And apparently in 2 weeks, she's going to be shooting her second Playboy, and it's going to be hotter than the first. And the crowd is happy about this, and I don't actually care very much. Ivory appears with D'Lo Brown. Ivory attacks Sable. D'Lo Brown and Val Venus fight. And then Nicole Bass jogs to the ring, not very quickly, but, like, more motivated than the Big Show, for sure. They actually say Nicole Bass, 6'3", 240 pounds. They call her a freak of nature. She chokeslams Ivory. I'm pretty sure I hear some people in the crowd chanting, "She's a man." Not great. Val Venus seems to be kind of eyeing Sable. Sable looks vaguely annoyed. What did you make of all of this, if anything?
Well, I mean, I imagine Sable, I mean, the problem with Sable is that, you know, when it comes to emotional range, it's very limited, isn't it? But yes. I mean, one imagines that she's pretty excited about doing the second Playboy shoot because, hell, that first one was a big seller. This second one, her price is going to have gone up for that. I mean, she isn't going to be around for much longer because she's making so much damn money that she doesn't have to put up with this crap anymore. That's her attitude towards it anyway. So, I mean, her promo was typically... It was just typically everything about her is wooden, let's face it. I mean, then Ivory steps out and the cat fight between Ivory and Sable, it's one of the worst I've seen. I mean, it's just like, it looks like neither has been trained. Like they didn't know what to do.
It was about as bad as Sable versus Tori at WrestleMania.
Oh, well, that was about as bad as it gets. So this was just awful. D'Lo came out with Ivory and had a bit of a scuffle with Val, and as you said, Nicole Bass turned up, and then she hit Ivory with this really naff looking choke slam. I mean, this was just amateur hour. It was bad
for sure. I mean, Nicole Bass is an intimidating presence. I think that she has use as a bodyguard, and I'm intrigued. I still don't know why she's with Sable necessarily. I assume Sable's just paying her, but overall, I don't really know what this was supposed to promote either. Is Sable fighting Ivory at the pay-per-view?
I have no idea. I mean, the only thing it promoted was Sable's next Playboy appearance. And by the time that comes out, she's long gone.
Yeah, so not the most effective. If it is promoting something for Backlash, neither you or I caught it. So maybe not the most effective promotional work. But finally, the segment we've all been waiting for, The Rock. The Rock comes out. He's going to deliver the eulogy for Steve Austin. He has a picture of Austin with him. He has a eulogy prepared. You know, "Dearly Trailer Park Trash, we are gathered here tonight to celebrate the loss of the biggest foul mouth, finger gesturing piece of trash." And he asks if Austin's Rudy Pooh candy-ass will fit in that damn casket. He has cue cards that he's throwing away theatrically, like, as he goes. He's obviously spent a lot of work preparing this eulogy, Finn. We've seen it throughout the night. And The Rock says that since he knew Austin wouldn't show, he brought something else to bury. This is where we see him wearing the Smoking Skull belt, actually. At the beginning of the show, he didn't reveal it. So this is where we're like, gasp, he didn't throw it off the bridge. He says, you know, throwing the belt off the bridge just wasn't good enough. I'm going to bury this piece of trash you call a belt 6 feet under and let it rot just like your damn career. I'm not so sure the belt is going to rot very well buried in an arena, but maybe The Rock just doesn't understand how decomposition works. At Backlash, The Rock basically says he will win. with lots of Brahmable puns and all sorts of things. What did you make of The Rock's eulogy before shenanigans start?
Yeah, I mean, it felt like he turned it up a little bit here. And it was a great setup for Austin. Everyone knew that Austin was going to make an appearance.
Of course.
I mean, people were just chomping at the bit for it, as they had been earlier in the segment when Mankind was getting beaten down? Was that when?
Yeah.
That's right. So, I mean, obviously the audience can't hear Jim Ross on commentary or Jerry Lawler and lucky them. But Jim Ross is reminding us throughout the program that this segment's coming up and that Steve Austin, I'm sure Steve's going to be here, won't let us down, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, we know Austin's coming out. So this is the setup. He's laying the table for the star to make his appearance. And what an appearance it was.
Oh, and make an appearance he does, because Austin is outside in a monster truck, Finn. In an actual monster truck with 316 on the side, World Wrestling Federation. It is decaled out. And Austin, you know, he's driving his monster truck. He asks a security guy, is that The Rock's car? The security guy's like, yep. And he's like, are the keys in it? The guy's like, well, I don't think he wants you to touch it, though. Austin does not seem to be bothered by the security guy. This is the worst security guy ever that The Rock could have hired to do this job.
I mean, and also, why would The Rock have left the keys in it?
Right? Take the keys with you. This is amateur hour in terms of keeping your car safe. But Austin, of course, gets in The Rock's car, moves it into the prime location so that he can run over The Rock's car with a monster truck, drives the monster truck into the arena. The crowd goes mental for this. They are so excited. Austin does have a beer and opens it while standing in the car, which is illegal. You shouldn't be drinking in a car, much less with televised evidence of such things. And I was like, well, I mean, I guess at least he stopped the car before he started drinking, but never mind. He does continue to drive immediately after. He drives over the hearse as well, which is great.
He just leaves the monster truck on top of the hearse. That's just so funny, isn't it? I mean, in Austin's defense, I mean, it's only one of those small, crappy American cans of lager. And chances are a guy like Austin could have one can and wouldn't be over the limit.
Oh, I'm sure he wouldn't be over the limit. But yeah. I'm just saying, you know, like, it is illegal to have an open container in a moving vehicle, or in a stationary vehicle. I know people who've gotten tickets and DUIs for just, like, sitting in their car with alcohol before. But it's okay. This is World Wrestling Federation, and he's Steve Austin. He'll be fine.
But have any of those people gotten tickets for sitting in monster trucks in arenas?
They have not. No, that is a situation that I've never heard happen. So Steve Austin... figured that he was going to be okay.
We know Austin does have some legal trouble in future, but at this point, he's fine.
He is all about contractual details, as we've seen from his interactions with Commissioner Shawn Michaels in the past. But The Rock and Steve Austin have a brawl, which I thought was pretty great. Austin kind of gets the upper hand. He gets his belt back. He's reclaimed the Smoking Skull belt, and he has beer, and it's really exciting, and everything feels great, and he's on top of the world. And then fucking Shane McMahon comes out, attacks Austin, kind of leaves him laying a little bit, and the show kind of closes on Shane's face just looking upset. And this is the point where commentary tells me Shane's going to be the referee on Sunday, and I definitely forgot about that until this very moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that had been laid on thick on previous episodes of Heat. So that's something I was aware of. It's something that had been stressed. I thought the brawl was great as well. Rock's always great fun against Austin. He sells for him so well. He's getting thrown into the railings. He's getting thrown into one of the monster truck tires. Austin throws him into the grave. I like the way Rock went into that grave. It kind of looked a little bit like he went in head first. But, I mean, mm-hmm. You know he's all right. So hopefully they had like a big inflatable in there. that he could land on. I'm sure they would have had like a tunnel coming out of the all the earth through which he would have crawled away and gone backstage, like what they always used to do in the Buried Alive matches. I'm sure he was fine, but that was something that was quite noticeable. Austin's so over, the fans are going bananas, and as you say, he's got his Smoking Skull title belt. I forgot. I thought it was Rock showed us that in the opening segment. I stand corrected. It was the second segment, the closing segment. So Austin's there posing. We've got a couple of beers. He's got the belt. And then Shane McMahon turns up, whacks him with a shovel. Austin sold it, goes down. And Jim Ross on commentary goes, Steve Austin could lose the title on Sunday. And that was it. Show ends.
And there is intrigue with Shane as the guest referee because, of course, he's going to be in The Rock's favor, right? Instead of Stone Cold Steve Austin. So they're really trying to stack the deck against Steve Austin still and get that title from him. I thought this was a great closing segment, and it made me more interested in Steve Austin again, because for a few months, Steve Austin was just kind of there for me. Like, he was exciting, but I was a lot more interested in what Mankind was doing or what the other characters on the show were doing. Austin coming out in a monster truck, having this brawl with The Rock, it made me more interested in both of them. And I'm actually excited to watch The Rock versus Stone Cold Steve Austin at Backlash.
Yeah, I mean, it's without doubt the biggest match on the show. I mean, there really aren't any other matches on the show that are that appealing. Maybe Shamrock versus Undertaker. But I mean, when you think of the other matches, what else on the Backlash show 6 days from now?
I mean, are you saying you're not clamoring for a Boiler Room Brawl versus with the Big Show versus Mankind?
Yeah.
Well, are you saying that Al Snow versus Hardcore Holly does not light your fire?
Exactly. So, I mean, there isn't really... I mean, X-Pac versus Triple H is on this show, right? And X-Pac wasn't even on Raw, which I found a bit odd.
Is it X-Pac versus Triple H?
I believe it is.
Very well be. I mean, see, I'm like, X-Pac and Kane are the tag team champions currently, which I didn't mention before. Like, it took me a while to remember who the tag team champions were with the whole Owen Hart, Jeff Jarrett, and New Age Outlaws shenanigans. It took me a little bit to remember. And then I got happy because I like that Kane and X-Pac are the champions. But yeah, like, they didn't really mention that at all.
Yeah, no Kane on the show either.
No.
So, I mean, this was the Rock and Austin show, opening segment, closing segment. I thought it was huge energy, you know, no expense spared with the set and with the vehicle destruction. I mean, this was Austin at his finest. You know, this is a segment that hasn't been played, or rather replayed, as often as like the milk truck segment and the cement in the Corvette. And various other motorized stunts that Austin was involved in throughout the Attitude Era. But I thought this was really good, you know. And I know in an Access in years to come, Rock's Lincoln, which was the car that was crushed outside, that would be taken to Access and put on display.
So that was
something that was retained, kept in the big giant WWF warehouse, as it was at the time, you know, which is like a WWF stock WWE museum. So, I mean, I thought the parts of the show were really good. I mean, the important thing was the energy at the end of the program was intense. You know, it was the ending couldn't really have been better. I mean, there were a lot of parts of this show that really sagged or lagged or were lackluster. And Backlash overall does not feel like if it were not for Austin versus Rock, what would really be your incentive to watch Backlash?
I can't really think of much else. I mean, Rock versus Austin is the only match that I'm really looking forward to on Backlash. I guess we'll see how it goes when I watch Backlash. But I mean, overall, this was kind of a thumbs in the middle show for me. It was, as a go home, it did promote most of the feuds. I mean, you mentioning Triple H versus X-Pac on the pay-per-view, I would not have been able to tell you that that was going to happen. But you know, like it did well to pit people against each other and show us that they are going to fight at Backlash. But there were bits on the show that definitely dragged. The Rock and Austin stuff was great, though. And yeah. I'm not always into the two of them. So for it to be exciting to me, I think is definitely a good thing. So thanks for joining me on this retro Raw review, Finn, getting, you know, out of heat and coming on to Raw with me. Where can people find you online if they want to let you know what they think?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter at Finlay Martin, on Facebook at Finlay Martin. My website's finlaymartin.co.uk. I'm sure I will be here next week as well, Sandra.
It's true.
Yes. So, and where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. Check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. We will have a Backlash review up there in some form at some point soon. I am trying to catch up on some stuff. I'm also working extra hours this week, so it's kind of difficult. But youtube.com/InsideTheRopes for interview content. Lots of stuff going up there from WrestleMania week. Also insidetheropes.co.uk/BookerT for tickets to An Evening with Booker T. And I believe those are all of the plugs. Whose theme should we use to play us out this week, Finn?
How about Billy Gunn's?
Sure. We will use Billy Gunn's theme. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk to you soon. Bye.
See ya.
Oh, you didn't know? Your ass better call somebody!